Accession number 4768, rule number 4.
Mr. Wentworth, 3L4. Why do you say that the Arabs were smart in damaging this pipeline?
By the time it took them, mainly, we'd have a patrol car probably covering a distance of a mile, and then there would be another one taking the next mile. Now, we'd go from A to B for 1 mile. Everything okay. We'd go back from B to A. Okay, that end. But when we got down there, there was a hole in the pipeline and they set it on fire. As quick as that. And it didn't take us long to get from A to B, you know.
Well, a matter of minutes, was it?
That's all. Another instance was, we're up at a place called Nablus. All these places come into the news, you'll have heard of them in various times. And there was a large hill went up from a Nablus fort. And the army were up there on lookout. All over the countryside. And early one morning, two of the soldiers came down the hill with a bucket for tea. They never got back. By the time they'd got their tea and had gone halfway up that hill, a bomb had been planted with a tripwire and it blew them both to smithereens. They were quick, there's no doubt about it. I must admit that I used to think that they were a dim-looking lot and you couldn't get any sense out of them, but they weren't, you know. They were all there.
How did they make the holes in the pipeline?
I don't know how they drilled them. This is one thing I don't know. They'd got some means of drilling, whether it was... it wouldn't be an electric drill, that's for certain, but they managed to make those holes.
Did they ever attack the armoured cars?
No. Not during my time. Not at that... on the pipeline, anyway. We did have skirmishes with them, but I don't think I was ever fired on at that time. When we got to later to have a near, yes. But I don't think they were particularly fond of armoured cars. I mean, we'd got some good guns where they'd got none, other than rifles. Ours was the only arms on any camp, you know, mainly. They were a little bit lax, I think, Air Ministry were in this. But there's a lot of things that were lax in Air Ministry.
Did the Arabs attempt to blow up armoured cars or plant mines in the road?
No, never had that. Never had that. Not during my time. No, I don't think there was ever a case, even later in my service, that we had one. We've had them fired on by the Iraqis when I went back, which will come in later.
So how long were you patrolling the pipeline for?
Most of the time I was in Palestine. It eased, but...
How many months would that be?
Well, from November 38 to... 36 to April 1938. And that's when I came on. Came home.
Were these the only operations you were involved in Palestine, or were you doing any other kind of work?
No. Any other patrols that we did were again training. We used to carry on training for... every other day. We're always at training. But you'd always got to, you're always on standby mind, and we've been called. I remember being called out one night and we had a Mickey taken from us by the Palestine police. It was a skirmish at the Dead Sea and there was trouble down there. This was evening. And on the way back we met the police coming back and they'd settled it. It was typical armoured cars. Rude remarks passed about us that we were late getting there. And one instance, and this is again where the car commander came into operation, going down into Jerusalem from Ramallah, there was a long, steep grade where we were going up, and I was battened down, so I couldn't see anything. My car commander said, right, overtake this vehicle. Of course, we had to overtake on the left, not on the right, you know. And I couldn't see what was coming down. He gave me the instructions to overtake, and down came a huge 3-ton lorry loaded with oranges. and he hit me. Well, I got out of the car, and where's this lorry gone? Couldn't see it. Well, he must have stopped, and he'd gone right down a drop, and he was upside down on his load of oranges. Of course, we got all the oranges we wanted, and the rest of the cars, not knowing this had happened, were waiting up the top, and they were buying them. Oranges out there, Jaffers. At Ramley Camp, at Christmas time, a Teuton lorry had come arriving with oranges at the guard room. These are for the airmen, given to us by the Arabs. Oh, there was no ill feeling later in my service life, but you were always armed. If you were guard commander, you always carried a revolver. Not that I ever had to use one. But
how did you get on with the Jews there?
Can't remember that I had a lot to do with them. We used to go down into Tel Aviv, which was our nearest town, and we'd see the Jews, but no, don't think we had a lot to do with Jews. One incident, I remember a very good friend of mine, the Padre, he ordered a book, The Wandering Jew, I think it was called, and he got a postcard, "Please collect your Wandering Jew." These little incidents stick out in my memory over all those years. I was very good friends with the Padre. I first met him when I arrived. I'd been told that there was a coach load of had been organised to go to Bethlehem and Jerusalem for Christmas Eve. Of course, from a biblical outstand, I had a chance to see all this, Garden of Eden and Holy Sepulchre and all the rest of it. I was always interested in the Bible. And the Padre, I went and asked him, could I get on this coach? Yes. He found out I was a Methodist. He wasn't a Methodist, but he was what we call the OD Padre. He covered all the nondescripts other than CV and Roman Catholic. And he was looking for somebody to look after his car, to wash it and such like. Would I do it? So I undertook that. His wife came out, and we used to take every Sunday night we used to go to church and go to his house for supper when we came out, which meant something to us. We used to have some lovely evenings. Well, if there was 4 weeks in a month, 3 of them he took services at Ramley. The 4th he went to Amman, and if there was 5 Sundays in a month, he went to Man. And of course, no preacher, so we didn't get our suppers. And I said to him one day, I said, "But we haven't got a few local preachers around here to take the service. You're the first." So I actually took services out there on several occasions. Not a thing I took kindly to. I used to grip hold of that lectern and literally shake. And that's how it worked out.
Can you describe what the setup was at Marn? What the units were that were there? How many people?
There was a permanent staff there. Now, I can't tell you exactly how many, but probably not more than 20. The kitchen staff were permanent up there. And then there would be what we call the ACHs, the general aircraft hands, rough work, doing general work. And then one section of armoured cars, and that was it. It was only a village outside. I don't know if I ever saw the village of Marn. It was really dreary up there. But then again, we accepted it. I don't think we'd accept it today. And then at the end of the 3 months, the same procedure. One section went from Ramley to Marn, we went back.
Did you find that there were more problems operating armoured cars in Palestine than in Iraq, because of the type of terrain?
Not from the type of terrain, I wouldn't say, but just because of this bit of trouble. The terrain was very similar. In actual fact, you see, Mosul is right north, as you know, of Iraq, and it was hilly. There was some beautiful scenery up there. Apart from the happiness of that station, which I didn't mention, was that climatically it was the best of the lot. I mean, Basra's a stinker. And Habaneer in Aden wasn't much better. And we used to see some lovely scenery. There was a Rondeau's Gorge, and it was something. It was really marvellous. We used to go, again, the CO, it was up to the CO, and if we wanted a bit of a rest, we'd go to the Gulf of Aqaba. And I fished in that Gulf of Aqaba at midnight, and then get a wob to take us out and fish, and then go back and have a fish and chip supper. Lovely life. Lovely life. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
So, when did you finish in Palestine?
March 38. That was the end of my tour in Palestine. I arrived home in April.
Back in England?
In England. Now, the padre and his wife and little girl, I'd done babysitting for this padre. Well, they went to cinema shows and they belonged to a dramatic society and all this thing, and I used to go and sit watch over this little Mary. And I remember the words she said to me. She said, she always called me Uncle Morney. Will you please, Uncle Morney, send me a coloured postcard? So I said, yes, love, I'll send you a coloured postcard. Well, I arrived home on Friday night. Saturday morning I went into our local post office to buy a penny stamp and a penny postcard to send to this little girl. And the girl that served me is now in the kitchen. That was the start of my courtship. And it went as smooth as that. Right now, the stupid part about this. I had remustered from driver to armoured car crew. Having arrived back in England, I had to be remustered back again from armoured car to driver. Now, there's no doubt about it that the driving in those foreign countries, and especially in Iraq, with all those S-bands, it really was skillful driving, let me say it. And when I got down, I forget where I went for my driving test to remuster back, and they put me on a tarmac road in a Singer van and drive up the road, and that was my driving test. Well, it was just plain stupid, and we all agreed. Well, after that, I'd had 4.5 years, and some of them had had 5, driving an armoured car. There's no resemblance.
So, where were you posted on going back?
Bassingbourne. Now, this is one I haven't mentioned in the names of stations because I was there only such a short time. Now, this is one of the dirty tricks that the RAF played on me. By this time, incidentally, I'd been promoted corporal. I must go back to Iraq. And we'd had a day of nothing but digging. Well, I was the leading car driver. And, of course, the first car to stick was the leading car, and the first man holding the shovel was me. And I dug it, and there's a lot of lazy louts watching me, and the CO eventually said, Wentworth, put that shovel down and do not let me see you touch it again today. Now, come on, some of you lazy beggars, and get mobile. And when I got back into camp, we sent the sergeant over saying that he'd given me a special recommended promotion to corporal. When I got to Palestine, I hadn't been there very long when the CO sent for me and he said, congratulations, corporal. And there was chaps there that had got anything up to 18 months senior to me who were still LACs because I'd worked hard. I must admit, I got my promotion through work. And there was almost a sit down strike behind the car. They took to that very, very badly.
And they thought they should get it just on seniority.
Yes, I thought, well, this is what they expected. Well, it didn't always work out that way. If you did your job, I found right throughout my service, you did your job, you got where you wanted to be. Mind you, I had no thoughts of becoming a warrant officer in those days. 8 years was to be my maximum. If anybody had asked me why, I couldn't have told them, you know. Anyway, I got to Bassingbourne, and this dirty trick. I was entitled after that time overseas to 6 weeks' leave. I called at the guard room when I got off the train at Royston. We were given £5 and told that more money would be sent to us while we were on leave, which happened. I'd written to the CO for permission to keep a motorbike on the station. First of all, I got 2 envelopes, one saying that some money would be sent to me, and the second envelope had the money in it, which again was something ridiculous. The next time, another two envelopes. I thought, by crikey, I'm doing well on this. But one was permission to keep a motorbike. And the other one was that, and then I'd only had 3 weeks' leave. I'm instructed to report to Bassingbourne immediately. And the remainder of my leave, how was that worded? Subject to the exigencies of the service, the remainder of your leave will be granted at a later date. And when I got there, I found out that other than a maintenance party, of which I was one, all the camp had closed down, and so that all the airmen went on leave at one time. The only station I ever knew that do it. And it was Whitmonday. I'd arranged to take Daisy to Skegness on my motorbike. And there was I, guard commander. Well, I think I must have been the foulest guard commander that ever took over. I really was angry. But there was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't say anything. We just had to accept it. And there was three corporals and a sergeant had been recalled on the same stunt. And I never did get that 3 weeks. I probably got 2 days of it. But that was that. Anyway, I was only there, though the CO interviewed me, as I told you he would do. And I was the last. B&W was always the last of everything. And there was eight of us. I was the last in, and I had driven him on a couple of occasions. Ah, Corporal Wentworth, now there's no doubt about it, you're going to sign on. So I said, no, Fred, it isn't. I'm not going to sign on. I don't know why, he said. You'll be a sergeant before long. So I said, yes, sir, and they will give me 10 shillings extra per week, and they will promptly take that off in sergeant's mess and mess bills. I said, and it's just not worth it. And I walked out there, I was going to complete my eight and finish. Well, 3 weeks up, I drove the CO that night, and he said, oh, he said, by the way, he said, there's a letter in, you're attached to the inspector of recruiting at Uxbridge. He said, what do you think it'll be? I said, I just haven't a clue, sir. So he said, probably the CO, the inspector recruiting's driver's going on leave and you're going to relieve him. So anyway, the day arrived, I was to go, and I was always a bit of a lad for taking more kit than I need, but I put it on the back of my motorbike and away I went to Uxbridge. Well, it turned out to be the longest detachment ever I knew. It was 12 months later when I collected what kit I'd left at Bassingbourne. Arrival at Uxbridge, I reported to the order room and told the sergeant who I was, Corporal Wentworth, to report to the inspector of recruiting. Well, he looked all through his bump and he couldn't find a sign of Corporal Wentworth. See Corporal so-and-so over there. So I had a word with Corporal so-and-so and he went round his records. And he couldn't find anything appertaining to Corporal Wentworth. So he said, well, LAC so-and-so is on pay parade. Wait till he comes back, he might help. And eventually they found that I was at Uxbridge on non-effective rations, which in fact meant that I was to go to London, Kingsway, report to the recruiting office in Kingsway and accommodated at the Union Jack Club, and the RAF paid me and paid for my accommodation and did that. So I left my motorbike. I was given a railway wanting to get back to London, so I had half my kit at Bassingbourne and a motorbike at Uxbridge, and I'm in Kingsway, London. Well, I spent a fortnight or 3 weeks in the recruiting office being trained as a recruiter. I was to be the driver, and there would be an NCO, as you would see on that photograph. He would do the recruiting. I would assist, but my main job was to drive. And I was given the first van of this fleet of, which eventually turned out to be a fleet of 10. And I covered the area, Margate, Ramsgate, Brighton, all over the south coast and around that part. And we had a record player in the van and we played records. And we had microphone with loudspeakers on the top of the van. And we would play a bit of music and gather the young lads round us where we could get young lads or parents. And we've gone out into the country, and when there was a few mothers around, we'll bring your lads, your sons round tonight, and we'll have a little dance on the village green. And we used to do this sort of thing. And it was left entirely to me. I had no problems. The sergeant eventually left me, and I had a corporal. When the second van was ready, we went down to British Films, I think was the firm, Ballum. Now, they'd done all the specialist equipment on the vans, and they instructed us on that, and then I collected that and I took it up to Kingsway and I handed over to another driver, and I carried on for only a very short time on number one van, and then the CO, who was a civilian, a reservist of officers, and he said, well, now, he said, I'd ask for number 10, which was Leeds, again to be a little bit nearer home and more especially to be a little bit nearer Daisy. So all I did was to wait till the next van was ready and go down to Ballum and collect it and hand it over, and I'd walk in occasionally to the CO. Haven't you any relations in London, Corporal Wentworth? So I said, yes, funnily enough, I have. Walton on Thames and very... Well, get off and see them. I don't want to see you. And I had 2 or 3 months doing this, and I did nothing until the next van was ready. And eventually number 10 came about, and away I went to Leeds. And there we covered parts of Yorkshire. I mean, Yorkshire's a big county. Part of Derbyshire, all Westmorland, Lincolnshire. In actual fact, I was recruiting in Scunthorpe at one time. And this is the way we did. Now, they allowed us... The ruling was that we... If we could put up at an RAF station, we did so. But if we didn't, we found our own digs and they allowed us 9 shillings a day, which in actual fact, once I'd left the South Coast, proved ample. I mean, Sheffield, for instance, I could get a bed and breakfast there for 0.5 crown. We got special permission to eat in the post office restaurant, 1 shilling for the meal, no choice, take it or leave it. Went back to our digs where I'd paid the 0.5 crown bed and breakfast, and we had a tea for 1 shilling, and what was left we had for supper for 6 months, and we were in pocket. I wasn't touching my wages. I was living on their 9 shillings. It seems strange in these days that you could do it, but that's how it worked out. We used to put the vehicle in at police stations. We always got on well with them. They were always handy. They put us onto good digs. And eventually we found out that the sleeping in RAF stations was not a success. I mean, I've known the time when, and I think this was always building up to the war, which in actual fact we didn't understand would be as soon. They were getting a lot of airmen in, and we had to wait till fire picket went on duty in the middle of the night before we could get a bed to sleep. So I wrote to the officer in London and pointed this out. He said, right, ignore RAF camps. Find your own digs. And we had some really good ones, there's no doubt about it.
Did you have to recruit? Did you have a quota of people to recruit?
No. We had a load of pamphlets and we gave them to them. We gave them a postcard to reply, and we could not recruit anybody. All we could do was ask them to join.
Just publicise the RAF.
Publicise it, as you say. And it was proved that number 10 van, by the postcards that were returned, that we weren't doing a bad job of work. Again, I'd made up my mind I was going to do the job properly, and I got on very well with the officer from London, who I seldom saw. He'd drop in on you. Mind you, we had officers at various places. There was one in Leeds with an officer, and again a reserve officer. And I would go in on a Monday morning and say, right, sir, I'm going to Westmorland this week. I'll let you know my address for forwarding my mail, or any messages you have for me when I get there. And that was it. And it never bothered me. Then I was in York once, and a cinema manager approached me, and he said, I think we can get together on this lark. He said, I have weeks where I have special items. For instance, if a man comes along in the middle of winter wearing a straw hat, he gets a free seat, and all this sort of thing, and an engaged couple. He said, why not use my foyer as a recruiting office? And anybody that signs on, I said, no, it was stopped there. I said, well, anybody that makes inquiries, I'll give them a free seat. And this worked out into a tremendous thing, you know. We eventually took over complete cinema foyers with help from RAF stations, and the armament people came along with guns and signals section came along with sets and all sorts of things, and it became quite a big thing. And we carried where we had Double Crown posters in the back door, we advertised now on this particular film that York was, what was the name of it? I don't think it's important. I know it was Spencer Tracy and Bernard Lloyd, but we got on to George Formby and It's in the Air. So the Double Crown poster that were the RAF one was taken out, and one was Come and See George Formby and It's in the Air at a certain cinema, and this is how we worked it out, and it all went very well. We got a record of the RAF march, which the music of it, and the organist at the cinemas would play this during the interval, and it really was a fantastic do.
How much interest was shown in the RAF?
Quite a lot. And mind you, we don't know how many followed it up. Back to London, we were given a stack of postcards that had been returned, and they'd taken no further action. Go and find them and find out why. But I think the idea of that was to make us find a way around London, because they didn't have to spread us around, and I wasn't too clever in London.
Did you ever come across any opposition or hostility to the recruiting?
No, on one instance, and this was at Kendal in Westmorland, and the police were to blame for this. We used to have to go to them and ask them where could we park, get permission to broadcast and all the rest of it, and they put us right next door to the War Memorial, which through quite a few locals didn't go down too well. They objected to this. There was the War Memorial showing the dead, and we were recruiting for mortars in the same way. That was the attitude. But other than that, there was no hostility, I would say. And we...
What type of young men were showing interest?
The 18-year-olds, mainly. There was one place we used to go to. The Wood Brothers Glassworks at Barnsley had two brothers, and one of them was in the Auxiliary Air Force, and he used to go to Yeadon, where at one time I parked my van. And he was not interested in workmen over the age of 21. Once they became 21, he didn't want to know. Would I go and recruit there? And I used to go and recruit there, and did quite well at it. A lot of them knew that they were coming out at 21, they would be out of work, and they, I think, joined the RAF.
You said that you didn't expect the war to come so quickly.
I don't think we did at that time.
At what stage did you feel that war was inevitable?
Not really, until I went my second tour at Digby, which I'll come to in a minute. It didn't dawn on me. I used to read about it, of course, but I didn't think it was so actually imminent at that time.
So maybe we can come on to your second tour at Digby now.
Well, just a little bit more on the recruiting van. We had the mickey taken out once or twice, you know. We wondered, having had it done how many more times. We were at a football match, a replay between Sheffield United and Grimsby, and we were at Grimsby. And we used to go there and play music while the crowd went in, then go and watch the match, very often get a free seat, and come out and do more recruiting. And this was after the match, and four young lads came along. Couldn't we tell them a little bit about the RAF? So I said, right, come on in then. We had a lovely office, you know, there were beautiful vans, stainless steel furniture and all the rest of it. And the corporal started by telling them a little bit of what the RAF was all about. And I looked and had all the RAF ties on, and in civilian clothes. So I gave the corporal a wink. I said, carry on, boy. So we told him a little bit more guff, and then he said, right, well, thank you very much, we'll be leaving. I said, you blooming well won't, boy. I said, you sit down there. And I gave him a right dowsing. And I said, where are you from? North Coast, Fittis, out on the Lincolnshire coast. So I said, well, I'm out there tonight. I said, don't you let me see you. I said, your feet won't touch the ground. You'll be straight in the guard room. And I don't think they would ever take the mickey again. But it made me wonder how many times the same thing happened.
Sort of airmen going to it and saying, just let's see what they'll tell us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. This was the attitude. Well, then I was in Barnsley one day, and there was a young lad came to me in uniform. There was no flamp about him, I knew. And he said, Corporal. I don't know if it was a corporal or sergeant, but that doesn't matter. He said, I'm just on overseas leave, and I'm going out to armoured cars. I wonder if you could tell me something about it. I said, you've come to the right chap, boy. I said, I've just served my time in armoured cars. So I told him all about it, and I told him the truth. I said, it's a good life. Anyway, several years later, I would have, after the Hab siege, and for several weeks after, we had a searchlight on the airfield, and we were sat around there. It was I was the duty car commander for the evening, and we'd lit in a brazier for us to make some tea, and smoke going up, and this was about midnight. And an airman sat through all the smoke, says, I'd like to meet that so-and-so that told me armoured cars was a good life. He said, I went up to a corporal in Barnsley. Well, I couldn't help sniggering, I knew it was me. And he saw me laughing all through this smoke. And he said, excuse my friends, but he said, yeah, bugger, it was you.